A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display? I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 238. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are talking about In the Flesh. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
So this was a BBC Three series, and it was about zombies. It ran for 2 series. The series 1 had 3 one-hour episodes and another 6 one-hour episodes. In the second series, it ran 2013 and 2014. And unlike most zombie movies and TV shows, this one asks us the question, if there were a zombie outbreak, the so-called zombie apocalypse, but then the undead condition could be cured, if the zombies could essentially turn back into something more like normal living humans, what kind of situation would we be left with then?
Yes, and it's an intriguing concept, a sort of 21st century television twist on the zombie genre. As you say, Brian, what would you do with healed zombies? Could you reintegrate them into the same society that they had terrorized? And it's a slightly grim and gritty series from BBC Three. That's one of the BBC digital channels, no longer with us as a broadcast channel. It is entirely digital and online now. And it held up a very dark mirror to some aspects of 21st century British life. And of course, as I say, we are, for the first time, I think, here on British Invaders, dealing with the zombie. So a little vote of cheers from me for that.
Yes, absolutely. And we are doing it with something that uses it as allegory in a way that's very strong, which is something that pleases me when looking at something like this. So the setup, the zombie apocalypse, or in this case it's called The Rising, has happened. And it's been defeated. The zombies, they rarely call them zombies, have been cured with a drug that has to be given daily called neurotryptoline. And we are now dealing with sufferers of partially deceased syndrome, or PDS. They are sometimes referred to as rabids when they're in the non-treated state, and the humans who dislike them and sometimes hunt them refer to them as rotters. So they're PDS sufferers, they're rabids, they're rotters. There are other names for them as well. They are occasionally, but only rarely, referred to as zombies in the series.
Yes, and I must comment on the use of the rotters, because I thought that was a clever little wordplay. I don't know if the word rotter as an insult is in common use in North America, Brian, but over here it's a slightly old-fashioned insult that meant a rogue or a scoundrel, or just a slightly milder sort of swearing that children could get away with calling somebody a dirty rotter. And here in the concept of The Walking Dead, I thought it was a clever usage, and as you say, it's frequently used during these two series.
Yes, that is a nice reference there. And the term rotter really isn't used in that way in North American English. I think that's generally a British thing. With the treatment that they're given, the PDS sufferers regain their memories of life before, and to a certain extent, their memories of what happened when they were running around as these rabid zombies. They regain their personality, and the rabid state is really suppressed. It really isn't there as long as they continue to be treated.
And of course, that treatment will allow for various mishaps and tense sequences as we go through these two series. But as you say, we've got these drug-suppressed rotters, and their appearance, their zombie appearance, is then concealed with very effective cosmetic camouflage makeup and the use of contact lenses. So they have the sort of, in their rabid phase or rabid state, they have the typical sort of white zombie eyes, but here they wear contact lenses to hide that, and lots of cover up to conceal their sort of pale flesh. And so here they are back in society, back and joining the families and communities that they once knew, and who they may, of course, have actually terrorized and rampaged through when they were in their rabid state.
Yes, and the idea of them still looking sort of zombie-like, although not quite the same as they do in the rabid state, that idea is used quite well, and the idea of them using these sort of cosmetic things to cover that up, and when they choose to use that or not to use that, and how much of it they're using, and you know, these kinds of things come into play, which is quite nice. It's an interesting way of dealing with some of those things.
So the characters we've got, quite a few through the two series, but let's start with our basics. We have Kieran Walker, and I wonder again if that's another little nice in-joke, because I presume this, when this series started, The Walking Dead on television had been going for quite a while. And I believe, obviously, the phrase Walker is what they use as a reference for zombies in that show. So Kieran Walker, played by Luke Newbery. Sadly, Kieran committed suicide after the loss of his best friend who had died in Afghanistan. And Kieran is our main focus as he tries to get his old life back with his family in a small Lancashire town called Rawton, a fictional town for this series. And we first meet him when he's at the treatment centre and about to be brought back to his family.
Yes, he is the focus of the series, and he sort of has his own story, which is important but not quite the same as the central story of the show. So there is some interesting character stuff for its own sake in there too. Amy Dyer, played by Emily Bevan, is a young woman who died of leukemia and who has embraced her status as one of these zombie PDS sufferers and is embracing the idea of the second chance at life and everything that can be offered to her as a PDS sufferer, and all of these things in terms of looking at relationships with others. She's really grasping her second chance with both hands, and is an interesting character in there as well, for sure.
Yeah, she's a fun and lively character, as we say, embraces life now that she's got her second chance. And although there aren't too many sort of openly humorous moments in this show, she certainly provides them with her sort of spirited take on Second Life.
Yes, a very spirited character for sure.
Another character who perhaps has struggles and conflicts is Jemima Walker. That's Kieran's sister, played by the actress Harriet Cairns. Now, her story is that she was a successful member of the Human Volunteer Force, and the Human Volunteer Force was a sort of local militia who hunted and killed rotters. So she had a successful and sort of well-known status as a rotter killer. The Human Volunteer Force very much struggles with and are opposed with the idea of PDS sufferers being returned to their town. And of course, for Jemima, or Jem as she's known, this is a real conflict because Kieran's coming right back into the house, and she really has to face it on a day-to-day basis.
And we should note that some of these characters, Kieran and Jem, the two siblings, are in their upper teens. So these are young characters dealing with some pretty intense things there.
Absolutely, and we'll see Jem return to school or sixth form college, I think. And, you know, it's a sort of strange, jarring transition for her to have to go back to being a teenager who goes to school when she was previously a sort of informally uniformed and armed member of the local militia, the HVF, and appreciated by all the locals for the work she did then.
And she's in this situation of being this sort of renowned HVF fighter who now has a PDS sufferer older brother and is trying to reconcile these different parts of her life. And we get that sort of internal conflict there.
We also get the conflict from the leader of the Human Volunteer Force, a character called Bill Macy, played by Steve Evetts. And he is, I guess he's the most vocal opponent of reintegration. He is radically opposed to sufferers of PDS coming back into the community. He can't see them really as anything other than the rotters that he hunted and killed. Now, interestingly, his son was Kieran Walker's best friend. It was his, Bill Macy's son, who went away to join the army and fight in Afghanistan and who was killed in Afghanistan. And of course, there's a dramatic twist coming, which we have to sort of reveal, which is that his son, Rick, will return to Rawton. And once he's Bill Macy's son himself comes back, then it opens all sorts of conflicts and difficulties, and it will reopen old wounds. And we'll get to know more of the story of why Bill Macy sent his son away, in effect.
Yes, absolutely. And with Bill Macy, we have a character who is sort of anti-reintegration and anti-rotter, I suppose. And he gives these impassioned and well-spoken speeches about this to the local community and the HVF fighters and so on. So it's interesting to have not only the sort of people who were hunting the zombies, but someone who speaks in this more eloquent way from that point of view, which clearly is not a tolerant one, but it's an interesting part of things we get in here. Simon Monroe, played by Emma J. Scanlon, is a charismatic leader of the Undead Liberation Army, which is a group that is trying to defend the rights of the PDS sufferers and to help them embrace their newfound status. And he is sort of this figure, as we get into season two, of an almost religious organization within the undead, as they're calling them. And we get at that point to the idea of the PDS sufferers referring to themselves as the redeemed. So we have a very different faction there that Simon Monroe is sort of an important part of.
Yes, lots of different groupings to keep track of, and they'll become more important, particularly when we head into the second series. But yeah, I mean, the undead rights, charismatic leaders, it's interesting stuff.
Yes, very much so. Maxine Martin, played by Wunmi Masaku, is the MP for the area where Rawton is. And she is an MP for the Victus Party, which is this new party that is a political movement that is opposed to PDS rights and PDS reintegration.
Yes, and she'll become more important again in season two. And as you can see, this is a show about the difficulties of bringing cured zombies back into a society, and with lots of resistance. And there are lots of people with very strong views on the subject in both directions. And that's going to provoke an awful lot of the conflict that drives this show.
Yes, there is a lot of allegory here, and it's really quite well done. And one of the things that makes it interesting is we don't just have one unified faction on each side. We have a number of different points of view and a number of different groups working on different approaches to deal with the situation.
And there are, as we say, several of the characters in a packed cast. We'll just mention briefly that in the first season, we have very well-known British actors such as Ricky Tomlinson and Kenneth Cranham, who play characters with their own sort of backstories that make up part of season one. There's an awful lot of characters to keep track of. Everybody has their own sort of stories and tragedies that came out of The Rising, as it's known.
Yes, absolutely. So series one, in large part, deals with the reintegration of these PDS sufferers or zombies. And we see that they are treated at a large medical facility in Norfolk, where they are given this neurotryptamine drug, and they are given counseling to deal with their memories, and all of these different sorts of advice and training kinds of things before they are basically sent back home.
Yes, that's right. And as you say, we're taught the various techniques that will cover up their appearance. But, you know, as we've pointed out, there's lots of conflict, and this isn't perhaps going to go entirely to plan, this reintegration attempt.
Yes, they're given this camouflage mousse, and they're given the contact lenses to cover up their appearance, and they're given advice and counseling, but we get the impression that once they've gone through that, they're sent home, and the Norfolk facility and the government wants nothing more to deal with them. They're just sent home to deal with things on their own and to let other people who are there deal with the situation without much in the way of assistance.
Yes, now, I mean, as you say, it does create problems for their families, because I think in the very first episode we get this implication that Kieran's family are trying to move house to a more remote location because they know he's coming back and because they know that it might cause problems for their neighbours and how they're perceived in their local community.
Yes, that's right. We certainly get ideas with that. We also get the idea that Rorton is an especially tense area where the HVF was very strong and dealt with the zombies very aggressively, and the zombie uprising itself was very very intense there as well. So this is sort of one of the most intense places in terms of how people are feeling about things and what they are doing and planning related to all of this stuff.
Yes, Rorton is our microcosm for what's going on, because we don't see anything really beyond that community. We don't see the rest of England. We don't see the rest of the world. It's all just set in Rorton, apart from when they are supposed to be in this medical facility in Norfolk, where they get their initial treatment and all the camouflage techniques.
There are some glimpses of other places, but it is quite minimal, and we do get the message that there is this feeling about Rorton as being the almost the epicenter of everything that's happened.
So we have the members of the Human Volunteer Force protesting the return of the people with PDS. We have houses daubed with graffiti, the HVF claiming that any house that has a PDS sufferer in it has to have a big sign outside. We have families being ostracized because their returned family members are now living with them. And it's all really quite a tense and unpleasant situation that Kieran Walker has come back to. We've hinted at the difficulties he's going to have with his own sister, who previously hunted people like him in their rabid or rotter state. And of course, we've got Bill Macy as the most outspoken opponent of the return of the Rotters. That is, until his own son, Rick, returns from Afghanistan. And the way that Bill Macy deals with that, the sort of deception that and the lies that he sort of makes for himself in order to accept his son as coming back to him, well, it creates huge tensions. And as I said before, old wounds are reopened, and it's really quite a pressure cooker.
Yes, it is. And they deal with some strong emotions there, and they don't shy away from some dark ideas of what humans do, and doing some interesting and rather dark things with that. We also get into more about the reason for Kieran's depression and his suicide. We learn more about the different characters as we go, and the things that are happening, how people deal with the situation. And of course, this is building to a rather unpleasant climax. But you have some rather strong ideas in here, because really what we're dealing with are human factors, and what the humans are doing, and what the PDS sufferers are doing, but really in a very human way. You know, they have their minds back, so they're acting very much as humans. So we get some interesting things because of those elements.
Yes, it's all very interesting. It's a short first season, just the 3 1-hour episodes, as we've said. A lot to pack in, really, with, as I say, all these old stories which are brought back by the return of the PDS. Quite fascinating stuff in a way that they've handled this twist on the zombie genre.
No, absolutely.
It's the opposite.
No, I don't feel ready.
That's exactly why you're ready. You're feeling.
It's not just the flashbacks. The medication, all the side effects.
It means your brain's responding, repairing. That's a positive. Count yourself lucky. You don't want to be a patient who doesn't respond to neurotriptyline.
Where do they go? The ones that don't respond.
We take care of them. Your parents, they're looking forward to seeing you again.
So getting into our production notes, In the Flesh was created and written by Dominic Mitchell. It was actually his first television commission, which is interesting. It's a strong way to start in television.
Yes, I believe he came out of a BBC writers program to find and nurture new writers. And here he is with his first season, or his first show rather, and quite a dramatic one. And of course, he's got love of the zombie genre, and in particular of the George Romero films, which inspired him. But he produced this sort of twisted modern take on that. He wrote all of season one, and I think he wrote half of the 6 episodes in season two. There are some other writers. John Jackson and Fintan Ryan took over for the other 3 episodes, I believe.
Yes, that's right. And the first season was directed by Johnny Campbell, who has directed a couple of new Doctor Who episodes. It was filmed in the West Yorkshire town of Marsden, which stands in for Rorton, which almost all of what we see, apart from a few things here and there, take place in Rorton. So using that one town worked quite well for them. The theme music was by Edmund Butt, who did the music for An Adventure in Space and Time, the docudrama about the beginnings of Doctor Who.
Yes, and there's some creepy sort of music. There's a nice theme tune. There's some electronic music that we've come to associate with the zombie genre as well. So it's good stuff. And as you can imagine, there's also a very large makeup and special effects department involved in this show, because whether it's flashbacks to the Rising or whether it's people who have missed their neurotriptyline dose for some reason and become rabid again, there are plenty of zombie moments throughout both series, and so therefore there's lots of makeup and gore and special effects. And the number of people noted for doing this in the production credits and IMDb, well, there's quite a number, Brian. Too many for us to mention, I'm afraid.
Yes, there are a number of characters who have to appear in about 3 or 4 different types of makeup. You have the PDS sufferer appearance, which is different from the actual rabid PDS appearance, which, and both of those are, of course, different from when they're wearing the camouflage devices. So we certainly get some characters with 2 or 3 different makeup looks.
It was produced by the BBC Drama Productions production unit, and it was, as we've said, broadcast on BBC Three in March 2013, and the first season was quite a hit, with averaging 500,000 viewers per episode, and did pretty well, I think, Brian. Was a hit both with ratings and with the critics.
Yes, absolutely. This is another sort of strong modern series on BBC Three that did interesting things and was considered quite highly. In fact, it won the Best Miniseries BAFTA in May 2014, with Mitchell winning the Best Drama Writer Award. So this is a new writer, and the BAFTA Writing Award is a big deal. So that's quite something to see that.
Yes, and recently we've been getting to some of these award-winning shows. I think we talked about Misfits winning a BAFTA, and of course recently we've talked about the Wallace and Gromits winning Oscars. And here's another BAFTA-winning show for its first season, In the Flesh, which, as we say, in 2013 and then in May 14 at the awards, was making quite a big splash.
Yes, absolutely. The second series of 6 episodes was commissioned in September 2013, and this time for the second series we had 3 different directors doing 2 episodes each, with Jim O'Hanlon, who we know from doing The Deep, Damon Thomas, who directed First Men in the Moon and Crooked House, both working with Mark Gatiss.
And Alice Troughton directed the other 2, and she has directed for Doctor Who and for Torchwood, and also for 2 shows, Merlin and Atlantis. So quite a lot of genre credits for the directors in the second series, which we always like to pick out if we can.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll note that Alice Troughton is not related to Patrick Troughton, who of course played the second Doctor back in the 60s.
That's a great shame in a way. It would be lovely if she was.
True, but it doesn't work out in this case.
We've got a slightly redesigned title sequence for the second series, but again with Edmund Butt's music, and it's quite sort of eerie and good to look at, as we'd expect from a modern show. And of course it aired in May to June 2014. So in fact, you know, while it was winning a BAFTA for the first season, the second season was already airing, because it had been recommissioned, as you said, Brian, about 6 months previously. And this time, as we said, we've got 6 one-hour episodes, but perhaps didn't quite hit the same heights as the first season, certainly in terms of ratings.
Yeah, I thought the second season was actually really quite strong, but unfortunately the ratings did drop off and it did not get a third series. I do wonder if that's also related to the budgetary issues at BBC Three. We did get to a certain point where very few original productions were being done for BBC Three. And as we've said, BBC Three is no longer a broadcast channel. It's now an internet-only channel.
Yes, I mean, there's, you know, as we'll talk about in our next episode, there's interesting stuff developed in the second series, but who knows what was going on with BBC Three. We've talked about there are other shows that ran into difficulties, and as we say, the channel itself eventually sort of foundered and went to online only. So who knows why it was cancelled, I suppose. So let's talk about the availability of this show and whether or not you can get hold of it to watch. As ever, in Region 2, we're relatively fortunate. We have a BBC DVD box set of both series. Doesn't seem to be any extras on there, but both series available for £7 on Amazon, or there's a Blu-ray for £11. And the DVDs, I believe, are available to rent from the Love Film organisation. Or you can watch the entire first series for free on BBC iPlayer if you've got access to that where you live, which is a very good way, I think, to get an introduction to this series. I've checked recently and all three of the first season episodes are still there to watch.
That's great to have that level of availability for something like this. In Region 1, we also do pretty well on this one. It was broadcast on BBC America, and it is available on DVD. Amazon.com has Series 1 for $13 and Series 2 for $7.50. Amazon Instant, for streaming playback, sells Series 1 for $8 and Series 2 for $17. And those are high-definition downloads. Amazon.ca here in Canada has Series 1 for $15 and Series 2 for $18, both on DVD. So a little bit more expensive on disc than it is in Region 2, but not too bad and definitely available, so that's good to see.
Yes, and like I say, if you do have access to BBC iPlayer, then maybe have a look at those first three episodes before our next episode comes out. Might be the way to introduce you to this show.
Yes, absolutely. Good idea. So next time, we will look a little more at Series 2 and discuss some of the themes of discrimination and other related types of things that the series explores, and we'll talk a bit about how zombies in how they're used here can tell us something about modern society and so on.
Plus, of course, we'll talk about the good and the bad of In the Flesh, and we'll give you our recommendations on whether this is a series you should get hold of and watch. So plenty to talk about when we come back.
Yes, indeed. So in the meantime, you can find us at BritishInvaders.com, or you can search for British Invaders on Facebook, and you will find our group there, where we have some nice discussions and posts about various things going on.
Yes, absolutely. Join in the fun at Facebook, where you will soon perhaps have a chance to win my copy of the In the Flesh DVD, which I'll be giving away. Or, if you like to listen to shows on internet streaming radio and have that on in the background while you work, then head to the Voice of Geeks Network and listen to British Invaders on a Monday and a Tuesday, but also several other good shows such as Pod Culture and Critical Myth. You'll find all of this at vognetwork.com. And as ever, if you enjoy what you hear there, let them know that Brian and Eamon sent you.
Yes, they have a nice participatory community going on there. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. Until next time, it's Eamon in England also signing off for now.